BOO. I'm your host, Linda Olson Osterlund. Today we come to the end of the year and we're coming towards the end of the year and we're going to be taking a look back at one of the most important developments of 2013. I'm calling it the year of the whistleblower, but it could have been called the Empire Exposed, the year the Empire was exposed. My guest is going to guide us in this retrospective is Carl Massinio. He's the co-founder of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. The PCJ is a public interest legal organization. Their motto is defending democracy and civil rights in the courts and in the streets. I asked Carl to join us because the PCJF has played an important role in exposing our government's undemocratic actions through freedom of information requests and lawsuits and demonstrations. They were the first to reveal the hand of the Homeland Security behind the Occupy crackdowns and followed with lawsuits about the Brooklyn Bridge entrapment by police. They've got an exciting new project going involving bus ads, and we will get to that. Welcome to KBOO, Carl.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be with you, Linda.
Yeah, I'm really glad to have you. I first became aware of your organization back with the Occupy exposures and was so grateful that you existed. And we used here at KBOO the information that was revealed to do many stories. So thank you for that.
Well, it's been our pleasure to work with you over that period of time.
Yeah. I called this year the year of the whistleblowers. And for me, it really started with the trial of Chelsea Manning. I know the year didn't start that way, and I know that's not everybody's way of looking at it. But in terms of whistleblowing, she played such an important role in the release of the information and the video of the helicopter killing innocent people, the U.S. helicopter. And then her trial, her dignity and her strength while on trial were really remarkable to me.
Well, she displayed tremendous courage in revealing truth to us. And what she was submitted to, what she was put through by the U.S. government, placed in terrible, inhumane conditions, solitary confinement, punitive conditions, for bringing to light to the public what were war crimes committed by the U.S. government that never would have been revealed to us with the raw data that she brought to our attention, but for her courageous acts.
Yeah, and she's going to be doing, she was sentenced to 35 years in August, and she is eligible for parole in 8, and she's obviously called, she's a transgender woman now and changed her name from Bradley to Chelsea, and is asking everyone to respect that name change, and she's continuing her fight around being able to continue her transition within prison, which is also extremely courageous. So I feel like even if she didn't directly influence Edward Snowden, that for me, one follows the other pretty naturally, that with that level of exposures and the risk this person was willing to put them to, it really was an inspiration to many people. So when Edward Snowden, I think it was just in June when we began hearing about Edward Snowden, boy, that opened up the whole can of worms that many of us knew was closed. We knew something was there.
Well, that's correct. We all, I think that many of us were aware that there were forms of covert surveillance going on, much broader than anything that had been revealed. But even from our perspective, I think that what Ed Snowden revealed was of an order of magnitude that was truly, truly shocking. We've learned in the past 6 months from the disclosures that Snowden made possible that the U.S. government is engaged in the largest, indiscriminate, massive surveillance against law-abiding persons in the United States and worldwide in the history of history, in the history of the world, made possible really by radical improvements in technology over the past decades.
And a willingness on the part of leadership to set the Constitution aside and act in abeyance of it, and knowingly, certainly through all of this.
Absolutely, and the U.S. government did this, perpetrated this in secret on purpose. If we step back the past 5 or 10 years, we see that there were a number of revelations of intrusive, mass, indiscriminate surveillance technologies that were implemented, for example, under the Bush administration after 9/11. And when they were revealed, the public and political backlash was so strong that publicly they were disclaimed. That is, the programs were in name said to be discontinued, but they were immediately re-implemented under new names secretly by the NSA in direct defiance of what the Democratic public will was. And I think that's a critical element. These programs were done in secret. They used the classification system of the U.S. government in order to hide what are their crimes against the U.S. Constitution.
And the earlier whistleblowers from within the NSA, there was a whole group of them, Bill Binney, Kirk Wiebe, someone named Loomis, and then Thomas Drake is the one that ended up going to jail as a result of that because he was in a greater supervisory position, I suppose. But these were men who all tried in every legitimate and straightforward way within their own jobs, within their own government, to reveal that there was something really wrong going on. And yeah, go ahead.
You see an evolution of whistleblowing, and you're correct. When we step back, and all the persons that you've talked about, when we talk about Bill Binney, when we talk about Thomas Drake, those are NSA employees. They were, you know, obviously committed to the concept of the state and patriotism. They complained through the established channels. They complained to the Inspector General for the Department of Defense. They explained what was going on and complained to the Congressional Oversight Committees. What happened? Drake is charged ridiculously with violations of the Espionage Act. Their houses were raided. They were subjected to tremendous, tremendous harm. Then you see Chelsea Manning, another evolution of whistleblowing, where she gave information to WikiLeaks, and you see the punitive response by the government against her in terms of the isolation and the solitary confinement and the prosecution.
Yeah, it was extreme treatment for someone being charged with this, but we're beginning to see not something unknown within our government.
That's right. And then, of course, the development of Ed Snowden's revelations, where he cautiously protected himself and was very, very careful also about the nature of the information he revealed so that he really could not be legitimately attacked as risking national security. He did not disclose agents' names, for example, but what he did do is bring to everyone's knowledge the massive scope of surveillance, domestic spying that's occurring against law-abiding citizens by the government.
I think one of the first things that people responded to was the shock that this young man who never graduated college, I mean, don't any of them have bright children? Many of them don't graduate college, but this young man who didn't graduate college and was not actually employed by the United States could have access to all this information. Why, how could he even understand it? Some of the media seemed to respond, you know, at first it was like, oh, this can't be, but it really showed us it revealed the other side of a lot of this that we're not going to be able to get into a whole bunch today, but that is the side that the commercial and corporate ventures play with this, so that, yes, indeed, someone who is not sworn to uphold the Constitution of the United States, who is an employee, a contractor of a company, can have access to that much information that's supposedly entirely secret. And we have since found out that, as a matter of fact, other people in his position have used their position to do things like spy on their girlfriends.
That's right.
Really opened this. What we found out is that our government's been doing a lot of illegal spying, and they're having people who aren't even sworn to secrecy to do it.
Well, you're correct. It's a reflection of how massive a money-making venture, a cash cow, the surveillance industrial complex has become, that Ed Snowden, when he set out to reveal these unconstitutional acts, he recognized that his greatest access to the information was by way of being a private contractor. they are so integrated that working for a large private consultancy organization gave him full access to all of the tools that I think we all thought were only, to the extent they existed, only available to government employees.
Yes. And let's talk about a couple of the programs or a few of the programs that got revealed. I find it actually so complex that it's confusing at times to recognize them. But there was the overall program called PRISM, and then there's also something called Co-Traveler that just got revealed earlier this month. Can you talk about the specifics of this kind of information, Carl Massinio of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund?
Yes, of course. The first programs that was revealed back in June was the PRISM program. And this is a program where, according to NSA documents, they were able to directly access the service systems of Google, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, Skype. Now, and be able to copy and mine our internet transactions and email communications.
And thanks to the EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation, we knew that something like this was going on because of lawsuits that they had filed many years ago that kept getting put down because they were, and I think they're reemerging those lawsuits because now this information is out there, but they kept saying it's classified, you can't even talk about it.
Well, that's correct. The lawsuits, I mean, the system of democracy that we have, the three elements of government is set up so that we as citizens have the right, where there are constitutional violations by the government, to go to the judicial branch, which has oversight or has judicial review of unconstitutional conduct by the executive. And all of the efforts, including those by the EFF, were shut down right at the beginning based on the fact that the systems were classified. And it's only because Ed Snowden revealed these previously classified documents and that lawsuits that had been shut down have now been reinvigorated and revived, and the constitutional issues are now being adjudicated. Now, they were still violating the Bill of Rights when they were doing it in secret, just as they're violating the Bill of Rights now. The difference is that there is power in information, and that's one of the things that Snowden has provided all of us, is information, so that as lawyers, organizations, or as an informed democracy, we can decide what our society looks like and what our government is entitled to do.
And that's now, so important. And, they've lied about it. Even as the Snowden's documents came out, they kept lying about it. I believe that one of the comedy shows, Jon Stewart, I think, did something very funny about, this. First they said this, oh, that was a lie. Then they said this, oh, that was a lie. And then they said this. I mean, they didn't even get it together very fast to start being...
Well, they did lie.
Yeah, they lied to Congress, they lied to the press, they lied to everyone, even after the documents had begun to come out.
That's correct. I mean, James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, in March of 2013 was asked, under oath, sworn, and this is a function of the Congress to conduct oversight into wrongdoing and the operations of the executive branch. He was asked, does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? His unqualified, simple response was, no, sir. A complete and total lie.
And now he may have sworn an oath that makes him feel like he's supposed to lie. This is supposedly classified, but it becomes really Orwellian in a comical way when they try to maintain that this is secret when the documents are already there with, people's names in them and email, all sorts of documents. I mean, really, the proof is there. It's almost comedic, the farce that they've led us on while they've tried to continue to keep secret how vast the collection of data on Americans really is. This is Linda Olson Osterlund for KBOO, and I'm speaking with Carl Massinio of the PCJF. We're talking about this past year, the year of the whistleblower, and also of Edward Snowden. One of the projects was called Co-Traveler, and that's about location collection. Is that correct?
That's correct. The Co-Traveler program is the NSA's massive cell phone location program. And of course, if you if you heard the Christmas message from Ed Snowden, then what he was referencing in there, he was talking about how we are carrying sensors in our pockets, and that's our cell phones. Every one of us that has a cell phone, and of course the technology has become, you know, prolific. I mean, everyone has a cell phone, are utilized by the government to track our locations, because all of that data, all of that electronic transmitted data is necessary for the cell towers to know where your phone is. The phone's in your pocket, they know where you're at, because they're engaging in a massive data warehousing program so that they can secure that information, store it for years at a time on law-abiding people. This is what's important about these mass bulk data collection programs. This is not, for example, where a court has issued a warrant because somebody has committed a crime. This is bulk collection data on every one of us, where we go, and it sits in data warehouses so that on the fly they can create histories of our movements.
My understanding is that also, you know, through the fusion centers, through the way they fuse all this and then they use their analytics, that they've shared that information with private organizations, not that are contracting with them, but that they just want to help protect, like banks and businesses where there may be a protest, that they literally will share information they've gathered about an individual who's never been tried or even charged with a crime, and even their facial recognition, and give that all to the business that might want to look out for them during a protest. You know, let's talk about the Fourth Amendment and search and seizure. Can you talk a little bit about how this violates so much?
Yes. Well, originally, a decade after the revolution, there was such a recognition among the founders of the country of civil liberties that they enshrined in the Bill of Rights protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. Basically, they promise that it's a restraint. The Fourth Amendment is a restraint on the actions of government that prevents its intrusion into our private affairs and gives us safety and protection in our papers, our effects, our information, our things against government intrusion. And one of the things that they were fighting and that was keen on their minds back in the 1700s was the general warrant that was used by the British, by the king, here domestically. And what the general warrant was a warrant that gave law enforcement the authority, without identifying a person, to go through and confiscate papers, effects, things, simply because they say there may have been a crime committed somewhere.
Well, that sounds like a direct parallel, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. This is the bringing back to life of the general warrant. That is, the protection that we have, the protection that was set into the Constitution, says that generally the government does not have the right to intrude into our papers and effects, our things, that we have a basic fundamental right of privacy, and we lose that right of privacy only if we engage in some form of conduct that appears to a neutral observer, to a neutral magistrate, to be criminal. Then they have to go and they have to get a warrant. They have to prove to a judge this person appears to have committed a crime, and that is what yields the individual's ordinary right of privacy. Here, that's turned on its head, both with the general warrant and with bulk mass surveillance collection. There is no evidence of wrongdoing. It is a big, giant vacuum. The government collects everything. And you spoke earlier about some of the different programs, the PRISM program, for example. There's the X-Key Score program. There's so many different names and acronyms. But what's clear is that the intent of the government is total information acquisition. They can, and in existing programs, type in your name, your email address, and because they've already vacuumed up all of this internet metadata and activity, they have all of your email activity, social media activity, browsing history. All of that is sitting in
data. They also have your financial records to a large extent. They get things in the fusion centers directly from the Treasury every 2 weeks, I believe, in an earlier work I did with that, and they also buy commercially any information like where you purchased something, what you purchased.
Well, that's correct. The power of aggregation, that is the metadata that they collect, and well, metadata they've suggested is not intrusive. Metadata is when you're talking about what you're doing on the internet. We have thoughts. We have personal thoughts. You know, we want to learn about an activity. We type it into Google. We type it into a search engine. That is now stored. Those thoughts are now collected and stored and assigned to our IP address, which is associated with our very closely with our identity. So all of that, imagine that activity, your email communications, the BCC lines, the subject lines, cross-referenced with the commercially available data. Think about what's on your credit card transactions, your credit card statement, just alone.
Think of how often, like, I went to get a particular type of doctor and then bought a particular kind of prescription, and the next day in my Google were ads for that ailment.
That's correct.
They're very up on what we do day in, day out.
Well, right. It's as if they were reading your diary, if you kept a diary. But the truth is, you could not create a diary as comprehensive as the massive data warehouses that the government has on every one of your listeners.
And for a moment, Carl, let me go to the question. A lot of people say, well, but if you're not doing anything wrong, how can this really affect you badly? And I know there's a larger question of feeling observed and being observed and how that works on people and changes their actions and activities. But I also think that people are a little bit willfully naive, because this is a government that we know has put pressure on Muslim individuals to spy on other Muslims to the extent that they've kept them when they've traveled out of the country. They've not allowed them to return, even though they're citizens of this country. I mean, this government is very ruthless when it wants information, and you don't have to be the target for that information. You might just work next to someone they want to know about. And it's at that point that they could go in and find everything dirty you've ever done, and we've all have secrets, you know, minor and major, and use those to coerce you. You just have to be aware of the ruthlessness of this law enforcement.
But historically, that is what has happened. I mean, this is not the first time. This is a response of government. This is the same thing that happened in the Hoover era, where the government, it's the same type of domestic spying. We look back at the COINTEL program. We know what happened there. We look at how that government surveillance authorities have been turned domestically in order to put down progressive movements for social change. We saw what they did with Dr. King. They had a whole program to discredit him based on his personal activities.
Well, and they attempted to torment him personally with false letters and...
Correct.
Yeah.
Ultimately, historically, the tools of monitoring have not been used neutrally. They are always one step away from becoming and from being applied as tools of social and political control. That's what these are. They are in a class of technologies that are technologies of social and political control. Now, we know that because many of these technologies were initially developed by the military for military applications, often in areas where there's occupation and they're trying to control a civilian population. For example, automatic license plate readers, which track movements of persons and now are ubiquitous here in the United States, were initially used by the UK in Northern Ireland so that they could keep tabs on the movements of the people there. So that we can't look at this class of technology and say, oh, it's hands-off. It will never be applied in an adverse way. In fact, they have undergirded, they've built a foundation throughout all of our transactions, actions, associations, collecting them domestically, and we have seen historically that surveillance leads to political and social control, just as we saw with COINTELPRO, just as we saw so many operations, the design of which, according to the U.S. Senate Church Committee, the intent and design of which was to maintain the political status quo, to disrupt social change.
Well, thank you very much for saying that so clearly, Carl Massinio of PCJF. You know, I want to talk about a couple other things. I want to get to your bus ads because they're so great, your bus ad campaign. Why don't we talk a little bit about that? You have appearing, and you can look at these on the web, so I want to make sure everybody knows you can go to justiceonline.org, or you can just go to thankyouedsnowden.org, I believe, and see pictures of these huge, whole sides of buses with big ads on them that say, protect, well, you'd say what they say accurately. I don't want to...
Well, they say in large letters, they have two messages. In large letters, they say... we the people say no to the surveillance state, and they say, thank you, Edward Snowden. And as you described, they are wraparound. This is a wraparound ad, and we also have advertisements that go on the side, the whole side of buses.
And they have his face on it, the picture that's most familiar.
Yes. I mean, they're graphically very clear and compelling, and they are on routes that traverse the most major corridors of Washington, D.C., including down and around the White House area. What we want to do is we want to send a message both to the policymakers that the people who were never consulted about these secret programs oppose them. We want there to be openness. There, in a democracy, this information should have been disclosed. There should be a public debate. And we, the people, should be able to restore the democracy to the way it was originally created, with a limited government that does not have the right to intrude into every last intimate detail of our private lives. This campaign is crowdsourced. That is, it's been supported by the donations, large and small, of people across the country who want to counter the message that's coming out of the leaders, the political leadership in Washington, who are labeling Ed Snowden as a traitor, as a fugitive, as a criminal, when we recognize that Snowden is a hero to democracy here in the United States and to democracies worldwide.
Well, we've noticed that even the administration is happening to, you know, they're floating out there. Well, maybe it would be worth having him come back, you know, instead of trying him for espionage. So it's pretty interesting that I think this pressure is working. I really like that project. People, once again, can find that on justiceonline.org, the Thank You, Ed Snowden bus ad project. We're all the way out of town time. Thank you so much, Carl Massinio of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund.
Thank you so much, Linda, for having me on and being able to reach out to your listeners.
Yes, and we will be checking in with you. This issue is not going away.
Certainly not. There's so much more work for us to continue to do.
Right. Well, thank you very much. And thank you to the audience for tuning in today to KBOO and to our engineer, Rock. We'll now move on to more of the Radio Zine.
And good morning from KBOO Portland, just a minute before 10 o'clock. It is a Thursday morning, Boxing Day. We've got in an hour, Between the Covers, today featuring an interview with Haitian-American writer Edwige Danticat about her new book, Claire of the Sea Light. And at 11:30, it's The Film Show with news and interviews about the independent film scene in Portland with SW Concert and Jen Chavez. But first, it'll be Flashpoints at 10, Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
KBOO is seeking a station manager to lead our dynamic 45-year-old non-commercial radio station. Ideal candidates will have nonprofit management experience, the ability to thrive and work collaboratively in a decentralized organization, and the ability to delegate, plan, and organize people to meet goals and objectives. If this interests you, please go to kboo.fm/stationmanagerhire2013.
on Flashpoints, we proudly rebroadcast our interview with radio activist, Flashpoint senior producer, and executive producer of La Onda Bajita on KPFA Pacifica Radio, Miguel Gavilan Molina. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Very special day we have today, where we're going to spend the entire hour with our good brother and friend and producer and radio visionary, Miguel Gavilan Molina. Listen to this. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Today, we present to you a very special program. We will feature an interview with our own Miguel Gavilan Molina, who has been a longtime radio activist, worked in the fields as a farm worker, worked with Cesar Chavez, has been doing radio, alternative radio, was a student activist and helped set up the first bilingual radio station in this country, and has been working here at Pacifica Radio KPFA on La Onda Bajita for decades, and on Flashpoints for the last 8 or 10 years. And well, Miguel, it's good to have you with us. And I've been wanting to sit down with you, particularly in the context of what's been going on up north, your community, with the killing of Andy Lopez. I know this brings back a lot for you. And I thought this would be a good time to talk a little bit about your own background. And then later on in this interview, we're going to talk about what you're doing now and why this killing of this young man is so important to you. But it is good to have you as our special guest on Flashpoints. And let me begin by asking you to tell us a little bit about where you grew up, how you grew up. I know that you worked in the fields as a farm worker.
Well, Dennis, I was literally born on the border of